The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although their locations, backgrounds, and methods differ, more than one terrorist incident was preceded by posts on Facebook or Twitter denigrating Western countries and pledging allegiance to ISIS. Social media networks have stepped up their campaigns to shut down pro-ISIS propaganda and recruitment accounts, but stopping distribution of gruesome videos and imagery is a slippery task. Relying on algorithms to identify offensive content is tougher with videos, so they have to turn to humans to monitor more than 500 million tweets and more than a billion Facebook logins a day. Hani Farid is chair of Dartmouth's Computer Science Department and senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. He developed PhotoDNA. That was a system used to detect child pornography online and to stop it from spreading. Earlier this summer, similar software was announced to flag terrorist propaganda online. We wanted to check in on the progress, and Hani's joining us now from Dartmouth. Professor Farid, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So the origins, again, in PhotoDNA software. Now, how does that system work to keep child pornography from spreading?
That's right. So the work that we're doing now in the extremism space has its roots in the child pornography space dating back to 2008. And back in 2008, in collaboration with Microsoft and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, we developed a technology that would allow social media sites, technology companies, internet service providers to find, remove, and report child pornography. And the way that technology works is it leverages the fact that NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, has a stash of millions and millions of known child pornography. This is content that has been reviewed by humans. In many cases, we know the person in the photo. And we also know that that imagery continually, year in and year out, gets redistributed. And so what we do is we reach into those individual images and we extract from them a unique digital signature that allows us to compare the signature of images being uploaded to, say, Facebook or Twitter or to YouTube or to wherever, and just simply ask, is this a known bad content? And if it is, then it gets, of course, flagged and reported and removed from the online service. So in that way, sort of the important distinction here is that we're not literally going into the images and trying to reason about the content. We are looking at known bad content, extracting a signature, and then comparing that against the content that is being uploaded.
That PhotoDNA software has been made available by Microsoft. You would be using the same kind of filter for terrorist videos. So does that mean you have to go in, look at videos, and tag the content?
Yeah, and so just to be clear, the PhotoDNA worked explicitly and only on images. So we have had to develop a new technology that works on videos and audios, which has its own technical challenges. But yes, you're absolutely right. Somebody has to initially look at the images, the videos, and the audio recordings, assess whether they are extremism-related, assess whether they violate the terms of service. And that's a hard job. Let's make no mistake about it.
Sounds terrible.
It's terrible. And by the way, this is also done in a child pornography space, which is also terrible. Mm. But the good news is, once it is done once, that is the last time you have to do it, because then the technology takes over.
What kinds of terrorism-related content would then be flagged?
Right. Well, that's the right question to ask. So let's separate out two things. There's the technology that allows us to find, report, and remove. And then there's the decisions that have to be made as to what will be found, removed, and reported. And that's where things get very interesting. So in the same way, in the child pornography space, what we did is we said, look, we are going to go after the worst of the worst. So we are going to go after images of children who are 12 years and younger and where there is explicit sexual contact. So we stay very far away from the line of what may or may not be considered child pornography. In the counter-extremism space, we do something very similar. There are videos audios and images that show explicit violence, people getting their heads cut off, people getting executed. There are explicit calls to violence. Do this bad thing to this individual, this group, or this organization. And those types of images and video and audio recordings clearly violate terms of service. There's no question about that. And those are the material that we are going after at the initial stages.
I'm just curious, though, what happens after something is flagged? It's just taken down? It's no longer distributed on the internet?
Right. So that's a policy question that has to be determined by the tech companies. But for the most part, if it's child pornography, it's illegal. It violates terms of service. It gets taken down. It may or may not be reviewed by somebody manually at the tech company. But as a matter of law, it has to be reported to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. In the extremism space, decisions have to be made. Some tech companies may say, automatic takedown, we know what this material is, we trust the technology. Others may decide they want to report it to the counter-extremism project so that they stay aware of what's happening. Others may want to report it to law enforcement. Those are interesting questions and interesting discussions and decisions that will have to be made across the board. And we don't have solid answers because nobody has actually deployed this technology yet.
So how do you envision this digital tool working in concert with the strategy to combat ISIS?
Yeah, so this is a multidimensional problem, right? There are geopolitical issues, there are economic issues, there are religious issues, there are social issues, and there's a technology component to it. And here's what we know about extremist group, and we're not just talking about ISIS. We are talking about extremism in the broadest possible definition, from white supremacists to groups like ISIS. And these groups have gotten very sophisticated over the last few years. And no matter what campaign we are seeing happening from these groups, there is a digital component to that, whether it's at the front end with the radicalization and the recruiting, whether it's during the actual campaign when they are live streaming the video of the attack, to afterwards where they are streaming video showing the attack. And every attack that we have seen in the last few years has this digital footprint to it. And that's the part that we want to sort of remove, this incredible global stage that these organizations have. We don't think that they should have the right to recruit and promote these violent views. And we want to sort of take that tool away from them. Now, of course, they have other tools that need to be dealt with by other organizations. But from our perspective as technologists, we'd like to remove that platform from them.
Hani Farid is with us. He's chair of Dartmouth's Computer Science Department, also works with the Counter-Extremism Project, talking about a software that he helped develop that detects child pornography online that could be used in applications for detecting and flagging and taking down extremist videos from ISIS and other extremist groups. Well, so you talked about collaborating with the government and talking with social media networks, but some of those social media networks have hesitated to embrace this system. What are their concerns?
That's absolutely right. And just for historical record, they also hesitated to deploy the technology in the child pornography space.
So what changed the tide there?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. I think we developed a technology with Microsoft. Microsoft deployed it. They started using it. They started finding a spectacular amount of content. And then Facebook signed up. And then Twitter signed up. And then it was an avalanche after that. Because now you can't say, well, the technology doesn't exist. You can't say that we can't do this because it's technically impossible. You can't say that it's going to impede our business model, because there is a proof of concept. And there is growing pressure from tech, from the government, and from consumers saying, why aren't you doing more? And I think now, 10 years later, we can look back and say, well, yes, this was absolutely the right thing to do, and there was no question about it. But during the process, it was a slog, and it was difficult, and there were hard conversations, and there was reluctance. And we're seeing exactly the same conversations now in the counter-extremism space as we saw 10 years ago in the child pornography space. I understand the conversations. That's not a criticism. These are big decisions that you have to make, and you want to think thoughtfully about removing content from your network. But to be clear, we are not talking about removing content that is dissent or political speech. We are talking about removing content that clearly, 100%, no questions asked, black and white, violates terms of service. So we are not defining for these tech companies what their terms of service are. We are simply reading them, the thing that you click on OK and without reading, and saying, look, you clearly say you cannot do this. And to be clear, the companies have the right to do this. Facebook and Apple don't allow adult pornography, which is protected speech, and nobody is jumping up and down on their heads about that. So the companies have the right to remove the content that they believe violates their terms of service as they define it. And we are simply creating a mechanism, a global industry standard, that allows them to do that efficiently.
Is there any way for an individual user to use this kind of technology? Say, a parent who wants to limit what their children see on television, you know, could this kind of filtering system be used to limit what an individual user can see?
In theory, yes. In practice, no. So as with photo DNA in the child pornography space and this new technology that we've developed, we actually restrict the licensing very carefully because we actually want it to be used in a very specific way, and in particular in the child pornography space and the extremism space. And so we actually limit the technology very carefully, and it's only made available to technology companies. So this is not a widely distributed software that you can download and run on your computer. This sits at the pipe of a Facebook, a YouTube, a Twitter, or a Microsoft, a Google, and it evaluates the content that is being uploaded. So that's why I said in theory, yes, but we don't make it available for that purpose.
So you said that you're in negotiations with the tech companies, that this is in development. Where is it all at right now?
Yeah, so the technology is in really good shape. We are at the tail end. I mean, we're literally weeks away from having a fully deployable system up and running with an interface that technology companies can use. The conversation with the technology companies is ongoing. We've had very good and constructive conversations with Microsoft and Facebook, but these are difficult decisions that have to be made. They will take a while to flesh out. So our model is build it and they will come. Build the technology, start to show that we can do this in a way that is thoughtful and respectful of the rights of the companies and the users, and is an effective technology that can be used in a very narrowly defined space to deal with what is unarguably a pretty serious problem that we are facing. I mean, everybody from President Obama down have started talking about the role of technology in the fight against extremism. And I think eventually the tech companies are going to have to step up and do something. You can only ignore this problem for so long, in my opinion.
Well, Hani Farid, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It was good to talk to you.
Hani Farid, he's chair of Dartmouth's Computer Science Department and senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. He developed technology to fight the spread of child pornography online and is now in negotiations to use it to curb terrorist propaganda on social media platforms. You can read much more about his work, including a thorough article that we read from The Atlantic. Links are at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The football team at Penny High School in the tiny town of Hamilton, Missouri, has won a number of state championships in the past few years. But football fame travels only so far. If you're from Australia or Iran, you're more likely to know Hamilton for another reason, as the quick quilting capital of the world. Producer Esther Honig has the story of how a YouTube series helped build an unlikely textile empire.
Oh, I like this one.
I do too. It's jumps right out at you.
It does.
Yes, okay. I like that.
Sandy Johnson takes her quilting very seriously. She's just spent the last 2.5 hours hunting for the perfect fabric for her next quilt.
What colors are you wanting to use in here?
Just the colors that'll go with this. Come on, Nancy. This is an adventure.
An adventure.
For many people, quilting is something their grandmother did, back when there was time to labor over squares of fabric with a needle and thread. But one family, the Doanes of Hamilton, Missouri, have found a way to innovate even in this traditional field.
Hi, I'm Jenny from the Missouri Star Quilt Company. Take a look at this great quilt behind me. Isn't this beautiful? So this...
Jenny Doan is the talent and face of the Missouri Star Quilt Company. Millions of fans tune into her quilting tutorials each week on YouTube. With simple tricks and a line of pre-cut fabrics for sale, Jenny teaches viewers, many who have never sewn, how to make beautiful quilts quickly and easily. And these millions of people don't just buy online.
You know, when you teach somebody a skill, they want to meet you, so then they come traveling from all over the place. I mean, we probably get 50 to 200 people every day from all over the world, you know, because the internet is so much bigger than here, Hamilton.
Hamilton, Missouri is a tiny rural town where Jenny and her husband Ron raised their 7 children. Not what you might think of as a tourist destination. But in 2008, the economy forced Jenny and her family to begin stitching together a different future.
They didn't want me living in their basement, so they had to provide something for me to do. And I can sew.
It's not far from the truth.
Al and his sister Sarah had long since grown up and moved out of the family home, but they worried for their parents' financial security.
Well, Dad worked for the newspaper, the Kansas City Star, and he was a machinist down there, and it wasn't going so hot.
With layoffs happening left and right, the kids were certain their dad would lose his job. That's when Al, who has a background in programming and tech startups, found a problem that needed solving.
And you'd called me and you'd said, like you were talking to me about, I think it was a quilt you'd made for Natalie. You said, yeah, I took it into the quilters to get it quilted, and I should have it back in like
nine months
to a year.
Yeah,
and I was like,
a long time.
I'm like, hold up. What? 9 months to a year? And you're like, yeah. You know, if I get it back in under a year, that's great for around here. Everybody's backed up.
Typically, a quilt is shipped to someone with a long-arm sewing machine so that the batting, a layer of insulation, can be sewn in to complete each quilt. It's a specialty service that had a high demand coupled with a dreadful service model.
As soon as you said that, I was like, wait a minute. Could you, if I got you a quilt machine, Ma, could you do it? And you were like,
Sure, why not? We'll give it a try.
Al and Sarah got their mom the machine, a dozen bolts of fabric, and a building in Hamilton for $24,000. Once they opened for business, the family, Al, his two sisters, and their mom, worked together for 2 years before anybody took home a paycheck.
You know, I would just eat soup in random kitchens and, like, you know, sleep on floors and air mattresses. You know, I had to find other ways to make ends meet. You know, like 3 years ago, my adjusted gross income was $4,000, right? Like, I was not killing it.
In the beginning, the business faced a few challenges, like sustaining itself in a town of just 1,800 people. So to reach more customers, Al built a website where they could sell their pre-cut fabrics online.
You know, when you build a website and you think, all right, we've got it all, it's been hidden all this time, and now it's public. Everybody come and see this, right? And nobody cares. We get our first sale 3 weeks in. It's my cousin Jennifer. Bless her heart. But not the sale that we were hoping.
Something different had to be done to drive more sales. At this point, YouTube had only been around for about 4 years.
And so Alice like, Mom, do you want to do tutorials? And my comment was, sure, honey. What's a tutorial? I'd never been to YouTube. I didn't know.
With a background in musical theater, Jenny was a natural behind the camera. Every week, she presented short quilting lessons while Al filmed.
Under the presser foot, make sure our threads are all lined up there. There we go. And we're just going to sew straight down.
The thing that made us really unique was I was the one filming her bearded 30-year-old son. And so as Mom's explaining all these weird old quilting things that, like, nobody understands, I'm like, Mom, I don't know what you're saying.
Al's ignorance about quilting provided a valuable tool for improving the accessibility of the videos to their audience. They found ways to simplify the language and the instructions. In the first year, they had 1,000 followers. The next year, 10,000. Their fan base continued to grow all over the country and even around the world.
And then the letters started coming from overseas. One came from a woman in Iran, and it was like 3 pages. And she ended that letter to me by saying, "You have filled my war-torn life with color." And literally, I sit here sobbing at my sewing machine. And I said, Al, I just thought I was sewing. You know, you don't realize that you're changing somebody's life.
Today, Jenny's tutorials receive over 500,000 views a week. Their site averages about 2,000 sales a day, making them possibly the largest supplier of pre-cut fabrics in the world. But what's most remarkable is what they've done for their town. Sherry Melton's had her job here in the quilting department for 3 years.
And there's a lot of people with my story. A lot of people have jobs that they wouldn't have in a town that was really dying.
Not only has Missouri Star created 140 local jobs, they financed the development of 3 new businesses, 2 restaurants and a bakery, in a town that was starved for economic growth.
This is a place I will be staying because there are opportunities. There's things coming to town.
The company has a retail warehouse philosophy that makes sure all 20,000 bolts of fabric are on display for their customers. Because of this, they now have 5 different fabric shops, all located on Hamilton's main drag. Together with their Sew and Stay Retreat Center, they've created what Al calls Disneyland for quilters.
You get this great feeling of like, I've come here, we've had the show, we've seen the tutorials, we've seen the demos. For a lot of people, they just love it.
The business has come a long way in just 7 years. But for the Doans, sharing that success with their community has been the most gratifying.
We got to give you a bonus this year. Like, that's the coolest feeling for a business owner, right? Where you pay them a good wage and then you say,
we did great. High five, everybody. Like, and you go home, like, that's the feeling that I remember, where you lay in bed at night and you're like, I can't believe that we built this. This is amazing.
By the end of this year, the company will open 8 more fabric shops in Hamilton for a total of 13. So where does this textile giant go from here?
I'm a really bad business person. I have no idea. I have no clue. For right now, I'm 100% focused on quilting. You know, we're gonna be the best there is in quilting.
I'm Esther Honig.
Coming up, a philosophical take on a question that has long been the subject of self-help books and advice columnists and matchmakers.
So sometimes having too much choice, having our choice limited, or not being able to choose, directs us into a better decision.
The author of How to Choose a Partner from the School of Life series joins us for a conversation about coupling when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. People have always enjoyed a love story, but up until very recently, our ancestors didn't live one. Historically, marriage was founded less on passion than pragmatism. Then romantic love became the benchmark, supported by countless novels, pop songs, and rom-coms. Now we approach finding a mate with bigger expectations and heavier pressure than ever, while always moving, feeling too busy or isolated to get there. How to Choose a Partner is a new book by Susan Quilliam that offers guidance, practical exercises, and research on the patterns and influences that affect the decisions we make about love. It is not The Rules, but the latest from the School of Life series, which draws from the humanities and psychology and science to approach life's most profound questions. Susan Quilliam is on the faculty at the School of Life. She's a relationship psychologist, author of more than 20 books, and sex and relationship agony aunt for Fabulous Magazine in Britain. And today, our relationship guide. Susan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good afternoon, Virginia. Delighted to be here.
Well, you write in the book that you were thinking of calling it How to Choose a Partnership rather than How to Choose a Partner. So what's the distinction?
Well, we tend, when we're finding love and we're looking for love, we tend to look at the person. We tend to do all the tick boxes, you know, as in online dating. And we think, oh, yes, Mr. Right or Ms. Right. Actually, it's not as simple as that. And at the same time, it's much simpler, because almost any two people can be compatible if they create the right relationship together. And there are a lot of people out there who can create the right partnership for any of us. So we need to be focusing on what we create, the experience of being with that person, not just whether they tick all the boxes.
And that requires a kind of collaboration. It means it calls upon you and what you can bring to it too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the points I make very clearly in the book is that you're not just, or you should not just, be looking at what the other person, what the potential partner can give you. You also need to look at what you're giving them, what you're motivated to give them. If after an evening together, you're feeling exhausted and feeling you really don't care how they feel, that's not a good omen.
Well, you make that point from the historian Stephanie Kuntz that our ancestors did not live a love story, that there were practical matches based on status and connection. Then that shifted to romance. And now we have this search for a soulmate. Is that a realistic expectation?
Largely no, because we can't give each other everything. Up until the mid-years of the last century, love was not expected to be all. God was there for that. You know, God gave us unconditional love and we were expected to repay the favour. But nowadays, being human, we still expect to deliver love and have love delivered to us 100%, 24/7, 365. And as you've just said, Virginia, up to very recently, that wasn't the expectation we put on love. It's a big ask for everybody.
So most people do still envision the love that they want as a goal for the future. Now, you suggest going back, not only to your most recent relationships, but the distant, formative past. What are we looking for there?
Well, a lot of our patterns around love, a lot of our needs, a lot of what we expect, a lot of what we are able to give, they're formed in quite early childhood. There's some lovely experiments done with very little ones, 18-month-olds and their mothers, about how the children reacted when they didn't feel loved. And we carry these patterns forward into our adult life. You know, we can withdraw if we don't feel loved. We can almost literally throw a temper tantrum. We can cling on and hope that it all works out. And of course, our prospective partner is going to be doing the same. So we bring all of this to the table when we form a new relationship. We bring all of it when we choose a partner. And in return, our chosen partner is bringing all of their past history. We don't really take that into account as much as we should. It's not the present that matters as much as what we bring into the present.
Well, say after making that consideration, we are ready to take the plunge. And of course, many people now, online dating has lost its, I'm going to say, loser stigma, I think, that used to come along with it. It gives people so many choices to investigate other people. But you have a chapter in the book about not choosing. What do you mean by that? Are we just leaving this all to chance?
Well, we can leave it to chance, and sometimes chance delivers, you know, Lady Luck delivers for us. But remember that there's a long tradition in human society of the people who are partnering, the people who are marrying, not making the choice for themselves because they're seen as not experienced enough. It's seen as the family and society see them from the outside. They take two people and they match them together. And very, very often this works out. I mean, of course, often it doesn't. But when I'm teaching classes on how to choose a partner, very often I ask the people in the class, well, what did your parents do? What did your grandparents do? And often there are some very touching stories of love literally after first sight. So the first time people have met is on their wedding day, but love grows from there. So that's one way of not choosing. But the other thing is, well, too much choice is actually counterproductive. There's a lovely, lovely experiment where people were asked to choose. Well, this is about jam, but they repeated the experiment with speed dating. They're asked to choose between 6 sorts of jam and 24 sorts of jam. And in fact, they found it easier to choose with 6 than they did with 24, even though it looks like they have more choice, that it might be easier to choose with more. But we get confused, our minds start worrying, we wonder whether there's a better partner over the horizon. So sometimes having too much choice, having our choice limited, or not being able to choose, directs us into a better decision.
Okay, so say you do narrow it down to 6 types of jam
yes.
Online. But online, people don't always present their most authentic selves. You know, we show the, as somebody put it to me, my profile online is as if produced by my agent, you know, their best self. So how do you get to know what is the right kind of jam for you?
Well, I always advise in my classes and with my coaching clients at the School of Life, I always advise that as long as you have a basic compatibility, you know, you both want kids or neither of you smokes or you have the same religious upbringing, religious preference, that you speak as soon as possible on the phone, you video Skype if you can, you meet as soon as you can, because it may look great on paper, the tick boxes may all align, but it's not until you actually meet face to face, virtually sometimes, you know, on the phone sometimes, it's not unless you have a real life connection you can tell whether you feel comfortable with that person. So I always suggest that people do that as soon as possible. And in fact, some recent research suggests that if you leave it more than 23 days of emailing, as many people online do, you're bound to be disappointed because your expectations will be so sky high. You'll have been holding your breath for so long that the relationship probably won't work anyway.
Hmm. So that actually makes Tinder a good option. You just immediately plunge in and meet somebody that's in your proximity.
Well, interestingly, although Tinder has somewhat of a reputation for, shall we say, quick liaisons, I have a number of clients who have met on Tinder and who have formed long-lasting relationships. So it could be that it is working that way. But you bring up another really interesting point, Virginia, which is what sort of relationship do we want? You know, if the sort of relationship that we're heading for is different from the sort of relationship that another person is heading for, then it isn't going to work anyway. And you need to check that out before you dive in.
My guest is Susan Quilliam. She's a relationship psychologist and author of How to Choose a Partner. It's a new book from the School of Life. She's on the faculty at the School of Life and teaches courses about dating better and exploring in depth how we make love choices and steps to make our search for love more effective. Well, Susan, one of the most enlightening things for me in the book was this chapter on connecting and this essential concept of emotional responsiveness. Now, what is that and why is it so critical?
Well, this is based on the work of a woman called a psychologist called Sue Johnston. And what she says makes every sense and is the basis for an awful lot of therapeutic approaches nowadays. And that is the idea that what we want from a partner may not be a good home or even a good family. It's whether they can respond to us when we need them. And Sue Johnston sums it up beautifully. Are you there for me? And can I be there for you? We're not talking about every minute of every day, but if there's a crisis or even, you know, a small wobble, if we turn to our partner, are they going to give us attention? Are they going to give us support in the way we need? And as I mentioned earlier, the other crucial question is, are we able to offer them support? Hmm. Are we motivated? Do we want to help them? Do we want to be there for them?
I think, you know, that kind of reciprocity, it shifts things away from this focus on the consumer model of I found someone or I'm getting a partner. And again, brings up that question of whether we are good for them. I don't know, Susan, I don't know if a lot of people think about relationships in that way, do they?
Well, certainly the classes I teach and the clients I see are usually very, very focused, very intelligent, bringing an awful lot of emotional intelligence. But you have to remember that we have only been dealing with partner search, partner choice, very, very recently. I mean, over the last few decades, as opposed to the last few millennia, where we have, you know, partnered up for marriage. So we're still learning, we're still getting up to speed on what it takes to choose a partner for ourselves in current society. And even in the last few years that I've been working in the field, we've learned a lot, but there's still an awful lot more to learn.
Well, you are suggesting that we are teachable about this. And of course, a lot of people want to learn how to find a partner. And I guess what I'm hearing from you is learn to be a better partner in the process. As you talked about earlier, we have this kind of imprint in the way that relationships go. You know, I think for a lot of people of my generation, we saw our parents not always in self-actualized partnerships, but they weren't aware that that was a requirement. Do you know what I mean? Like, most of us do not have a lot of great models in our lives of real partnerships.
We don't. And if those real partnerships are in our lives, they don't usually, as you've just said, talk about it. You know, how many parents sit their children down and say, you know, we're happy together, but we've had our rough times. And when we've had our rough times, this is how we've got through them. We just don't have that conversation. Love is almost more private than sexuality nowadays. And one of the really interesting exercises we do at the School of Life is we spend probably an hour or so looking at our past, but also looking at the media, at the lessons we've learned at school, at the lessons we've learned through our culture, the lessons we've learned from our peers, the lessons we've learned from our families, and put together a picture of, well, what are our expectations of love and partnership? And very often, those models, as you've just said, they're not so much shallow as they're missing. You know, take a simple example from the media. Almost every book, almost every film presents an ideal of romance that is quite far removed from what we experience in a normal relationship. That phrase, they lived happily ever after, has an awful lot to answer for when it comes to making a real-life human relationship work.
Susan, you revised The Joy of Sex. There was a modern update in 2008 for, you know, more modern sensibilities. We haven't really talked about sex and sexuality and the role that that plays in a partnership. Is that, like, the idea of soulmate no longer the sole guide?
I think it is no longer the sole guide, or it is no longer the sole guide for many people. But in partnership, there are very few people who initially and at the start are willing and happy to have a relationship without sexuality. But of course, one of the big challenges later on, perhaps after children, perhaps as, you know, you get older, is that sexuality in your relationship may die away. You know, sometimes it will just diminish, other times it will disappear entirely from no fault of your own. So one of the things that we're learning is that lust alone does not make for a long-term partnership. That said, the ability to lust probably lasts longer in our generation, you know, in our society, than it ever has done in the past, simply because we have better healthcare, we have more expectations about enjoying sex as we get older, and we have encouragement and permission to do so.
Susan Quilliam, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Virginia.
Susan Quilliam, a relationship psychologist and author of more than 20 books, including most recently How to Choose a Partner. It's a new book from the School of Life series. You find links to more on the book and to the School of Life website, which has a toolkit, including Who Should I Be With? It is a card game designed to sharpen our sense of what we should be looking for in love. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked with Susan Quilliam about the challenges of choosing a partner. Now we turn to a real-life story of love found. Last August, Paul Hammond and Laura Jackman were getting ready to tie the knot when they saw an online post from the Museum of Durham History requesting stories of love. All they had to do was show up, and a producer would record their story. That producer was Emma Miller, who narrates this audio piece in which Paul and Laura talk about how they met, fell in love, and then decided to share their vows with their entire town on their wedding day.
Paul Hammond and Laura Jackman first met 2.5 years ago. At the time, Laura was a manager at Foster's Market, a cafe in Durham. Paul was a regular. He'd come by in the mornings for coffee.
I came in one day and there was a new girl there, and she had this really wide smile and she was bouncy and really cute.
And I had been moved to one morning shift a week and saw him and quickly requested to be moved to all morning shifts.
She just caught my eye immediately and I kind of started like crushing on her, I guess, and thought she was adorable and decided, made up my mind within about a week that I needed to ask her out.
So Paul did ask her out, and they started dating, and things progressed pretty quickly from there. And eventually, as couples do when they really like each other, they started to think about the future. The future with a capital F.
In terms of when we shifted in to thinking about marriage...
It was about a year ago.
About a year ago. I guess... I mean, we were happy together. I think we were living together. We were living together at that point.
Yeah.
We liked each other. And it finally just occurred to me, it's just like, why? He's supporting me, he loves me, he's a great guy, we have a wonderful time together, why wouldn't I marry him?
I broached it briefly one night. We were out and Lara was talking about wanting to have a dog, and just kind of impulsively I said, well, we definitely can't have a dog. I think we should wait until we're... And then I stopped. And I stopped, and I was like, oh. And I just kind of looked around, and she immediately was very, very intrigued. I guess about a month later, went up to the mountains, and I hadn't really decided when or where I was going to ask her to marry me, but on the way to the mountains, Lara was kind of like, you know, this would be a good place to do that if you wanted to do that.
You were saying, you know, I was thinking about it this weekend, and then you said, but I don't have a ring. And I think I said, I don't care, I'm not marrying you for a ring. So we went forward.
We went forward.
Now here's where I should say that today, the day I'm talking with Paul and Lara, is actually the day of their wedding. They're heading to Paul's mother's house in Durham later this evening for a big backyard ceremony with all their friends and family. But you never know it looking at them. They're both just so relaxed and at ease. I want to know how they're both so calm on what may well be one of the most important days of their lives.
You know, it's in a yard. It's not a huge venue. It's a place we're comfortable. We love each other. We love our friends. We love our family.
What really can go wrong is what we've been saying.
Yeah, really the key stress point for me was reading vows in front of a bunch of people. I hate to read anything or do anything in front of large groups. Mm-hmm. So when we heard about this, we're like, oh, we could just do it here, and then people can listen to them later, and it'll be fun. So that was,
yeah,
that was really my only stress point.
So that's why they're here, talking with me, because they want to read their vows.
Now a good time?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sure. You want to go first?
I'll go first.
I haven't heard her vows yet.
I did hear his. Paul Hammond, you're my heart and my world, and I will love you for my whole life. I promise to treat you like an equal. I'll do my best to keep you happy, including not limiting your sporting activities. I'll be honest with you in all things and not take you for granted. I promise to talk to you and to listen and to remember. I'll be true and faithful to you. I also promise that we can try to have 2 children, so long as we stick to the agreed upon naming convention. I love you, Polly. I'm glad I get to spend the rest of my life with you.
Thanks, babe. Lara, my queen, my rascal, my fink, my sugar plum. All the nicknames in the world cannot convey the way I feel about you. I love you from deep inside my heart. I will continue to love you for the rest of our lives. I promise to keep you safe and happy, to work hard at being good to you, to take time to listen to hear you. Yes, ma'am, is my plan. Whatever you say is the way. I promise to be honest with you and to tell you everything. I promise to be true to you and to continue to love your beauty forever. You are my sunshine. I will do whatever it takes to make you happy. I know that I'm very lucky to have found someone who cares about me so deeply. I promise to never take that for granted. When you need me, I promise, within all of my power, I will be there for you forever and ever.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Good vows.
Good vows.
How do you feel now?
I feel very good.
Yeah.
I feel very good.
And that piece was produced by Emma Miller. You can listen to the full, unedited audio from Paul and Laura's story, as well as other participants in the Museum of Durham History's project, Durham Love Stories. We've got a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Here's a stat I came across while preparing for the How to Choose a Partner interview with Susan Quilliam. Divorce is growing more rapidly among people over 50 than any other cohort. It's also the demographic most resistant to online dating. The hitch? You are less likely to meet someone offline if you're over 50 and single. So why not try it out? Just be wary of advice offered by supposed experts, like those encouraging women in particular to lie about their age. Well, Susan Quilliam would advise against that, or against writing a shopping list. You're not going to the superstore, you're taking a chance. And bully for you for trying it. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. Music in this episode came to us from Eric Skiff, Jason Leonard, Blue Dot Sessions, Broke for Free, and Kevin MacLeod. I'm Virginia Prescott. You can listen back to segments, share them, or communicate with us on Facebook, Twitter, or wordofmouthradio.org. Or join us again live tomorrow, too, right here on NHPR.